Hello, and you are listening to EcoJustice Radio. We present environmental, cultural, and climate stories from a social justice frame. We amplify community voices, broaden the reach of grassroots movements, and inspire action. My name is Jack Eyte, and let's travel into the wild grasslands, climb the high altiplano. With a view into other worlds, we endeavor to chart a path through those meteors coming at us, beyond nests of raptors and towering cedars, and into the realm of eco-justice. On today's show, Nature's Remedy, Healing Our Earth with Ecological Remediation. Host Carrie Kim will be interviewing Danielle Stevenson, a pioneering mycologist, environmental scientist, and educator specializing in micro-remediation and sustainable practices. Danielle Stevenson founded and runs the Center for Applied Ecological Remediation, or CAER. She's an environmental toxicologist with expertise in soil, water, and waste remediation. She has led community, academic, governmental partnerships to develop accessible soil testing programs and implement nature-based cleanup strategies, including plant fungal remediation models. As background to this show, we feature this clip from the 2024 Bioneers Conference. Merlin Sheldrake, the biologist and best-selling author of Entangled Life, How Fungi Make Our World.
I'm going to talk about fungi, because I can assume that you all know about fungi. You know that this is a kingdom of life. You know that these are ecosystem engineers that underwrite the regenerative capacity of the living world. You know that there are lots of ways to be a fungus. I'm going to talk about a specific group of fungi called mycorrhizal fungi. And I know you've also heard something of mycorrhizal fungi, which is great. So I can just give a small recap. Mycorrhizal fungi are fungi that form very intimate and ancient relationships with plants. And I'm going to ask here, I'm going to hold the focus steady on the question of how can we nourish generative relationships with mycorrhizal fungi to support the flourishing of life on Earth and to help address the coupled crises of climate change and biodiversity loss. So almost all plants depend on mycorrhizal fungi, and these are fungi that form mycelial networks, which are branching, fusing networks of tubular cells. And these fungi are brilliant. They're chemical wizards. They're brilliant navigators in the wild, wet world of the soil. They're able to grow and remodel their bodies and forage using their chemical ingenuity for nutrients, nutrients that plants need, like nitrogen and phosphorus. They acquire these nutrients and they supply these nutrients to their plant partners. And the plant partners, in exchange for these nutrients, they provide the fungi with things that the fungi need to grow. Energy-containing carbon compounds like sugars and fats that the plants have made in photosynthesis. So this is a very intimate relationship. And this is really an intermingling of bodies. It's one of the living world's great intimacies. I suppose I would say that, but I really do believe it. An astonishing way that organisms can come together to extend their reach and to make things possible that wouldn't otherwise be possible. Now, this is really actually the roots of life on land. Plants would only make it out of water and onto the land with the help of their fungal associates, who behaved as their root systems for tens of millions of years until plants could evolve their own roots.
Aloha, this is Carrie Kim. Listeners, today we are excited to welcome back Danielle Stevenson, founder and executive director of the Center for Applied Ecological Remediation, or CARE, to continue our conversations on ecological remediation, phyto and myco remediation, remediating toxic sites, as well as post-fire and ecosystem restoration. She innovates in a nature-based techniques to restore contaminated land, allowing fungi and native plants to break down toxins such as petroleum, plastics, and pesticides into less toxic chemicals. CARE's mission is to advance research and application of ecological remediation to equitably address pollution, promote public health, provide education and workforce development, build climate resilience, and ensure environmental justice. Regeneration is possible in even the most dire situations if we follow the ways of nature. Danielle Stevenson joins us to explain how we can be part of this collective remembrance. Danielle.
Hi.
Welcome back. Third time's a charm.
Thank you.
So, you know, your visit is a timely one, given the backdrop of regulatory capture, the potential doubling down on glyphosate, biocides, pesticides. This all looms large for this continent and beyond. We are, as many of us know, living, breathing, and eating a wide range of toxic pollutants on a daily basis. There is exposure to PFAS and metals of concern, including arsenic, lead, chromium. You could give us a much longer list, I'm sure. But we understand these happenings are radical opportunities to change our ways and return to upholding nature as a sacred living inheritance to respect and protect. So we thank you, Danielle, for being here. We do want to also honor the Tongva ancestors, as our show comes to you from the ancestral homelands of the Tongva, and we invite all listeners to align with the indigenous peoples, the original peoples of the area where you now live, to align with them and to act on their behalf for their continuance. Danielle, you know, first of all, I want to celebrate the opening and already the expansion of CARE, your new lab in Yagna, aka downtown LA.
It's so exciting. It's a dream come true.
Yeah. I mean, what does it mean to you having this lab available now?
It means that we can grow fungi to support, you know, local projects, helping clean up after the recent catastrophic wildfires in LA, and to support cleanup of industrially contaminated sites around LA. It also means we have space to provide free and low cost soil contaminant testing for, you know, throughout the city of LA. So it's really exciting to have a space to come together and grow and do this work.
Yeah, we truly, truly thank you for your commitment to this, because we know it's so essential, and especially living here with the amount of pollution that we're assaulted with here every day. Mm. Do you feel that the opening of your lab signifies some kind of forward movement in the direction of nature-based remediation with fungi, native plants? Do you feel that there's a greater embrace, curiosity, alignment with these? Mm-hmm.
I do. I really do. I think the fires in LA really brought top of mind, you know, pollution to people who maybe hadn't been as aware before. Yeah. And those people include funders, right? So, you know, funders who suddenly were like, wait, what do we do about widespread pollution? There's got to be a better way. It was interesting because I noticed one of the major points that stood out for funders was that we were dumping toxic materials in other communities. And they were like, wait, that's not a solution. And I was like, yeah, exactly. It really, really isn't. And so, yeah, it does feel like a big moment and a really good sign. Well, I guess it depends how you see it, right? It's a good sign that there's support for these more nature-based methods of cleaning up pollution.
Well, I think it's kind of also when it's in their own backyards, right? When it's right there and you know all explosives pollution. And then you realize, oh, all these other people. And then you kind of, how can you be so exceptional? You know?
Yes. For sure.
Especially when there's all these people and what's happened here, you know, it does feel that the fires, post fires here, really woke a lot of people up to also just, there's corruption, but then there's also what we're doing to the environment on every level. You know, are you finding that the lab also kind of a way to outreach and educate more people about this potential need? Are you doing, you know, lab tours, or what, how are the ways you're doing outreach with community?
Yeah, we're doing a lot of outreach, actually. It's like unprecedented levels of outreach. We do a lot of in-person events, like info sessions at like churches and, you know, schools and all kinds of different community settings, long-term recovery centers and spaces like that, community farms. And then we're also doing a lot of virtual and online outreach just to reach more people where they're at and whether they can leave home or not. So it's just been, I think I've done over 30 talks or workshops in the last few weeks, which is a lot. So yeah, we're doing a lot of, trying to meet people where they're at and share information about, how to do soil testing, what does it mean, how to interpret it, and then things folks can do, at an individual or community scale to address pollution where they live.
You know, I wonder, could you backtrack for any new listeners? We've had two other prior shows with Danielle in interviews, but could you share from the beginning, like, what is ecological remediation or nature-based remediation for anyone not familiar with those terms?
Yeah, good call. So, well, remediation means just cleaning up, addressing pollution in the environment. And usually that's done through just moving the pollution somewhere else, whether that's soil or waste or whatever. And so nature-based or bioremediation involves working with living organisms like plants and fungi and microbes to clean up pollution in place. And there's a lot of advantages of that. With ecological remediation, we're basically bridging pollution cleanup and ecological restoration or regeneration. So we take things a little bit further, instead of just putting in, one type of living organism, like putting in, compost or just plants or just fungi, we look at the system as a whole and try to sort of support regeneration and correct any imbalances. So that often looks like making sure really important species are present, like mycorrhizal fungi, which we can talk more about, the plant supporting fungi that live underground. It might look like looking at what the whole system needs to heal and recover. So maybe, maybe water is needed or other types of supports. And then, looking too at like cycles of regeneration. So recognizing that often after a big disturbance, like a fire or pollution or whatever it may be, there are certain kinds of organisms that really thrive in those really disturbed environments. Mm-hmm. And they can kind of kick off making, supporting them and getting them in place can really help kick off these cycles of regeneration that can take hold. And also like diversity is resilience, right? So not just, sometimes bioremediation, it involves, like I said, just putting in one, you're like, okay, I'm planting sunflowers. But ecological remediation would be looking at like, okay, well, let's put in a bunch of different types of plants. Let's put in a bunch of different fungi. And also being mindful of not introducing invasive species and things like that, respecting local ecologies and bioregional approaches. So yeah, altogether, there's a lot of kind of terms that could be thrown around. But ecological remediation is like this bridge between, cleaning up pollution with living organisms, but also looking at ecological regeneration instead of just the pollution cleanup part.
Much bigger picture, which we know we need. We know that that's the longevity piece, right? Just like all the tree planting projects, you can't just plant the tree and then walk away and think it's going to be there still, growing.
Right. And it honestly, it kind of blows my mind. I've been going to a lot of conferences lately about fire. And it's so strange to me that there's still like planting efforts that have like 90% mortality, like everything dies. And then they just keep doing it. It's like, well, maybe.
Much better for the longevity, to have the continuum. I wonder if you could, speaking of, again, about ecological remediation, if you might be able to share some of those basic principles. I think they're also listed on your site. Several, and that they're very, I think very helpful for people to understand.
Yeah. So one of the principles of ecological remediation is, ecological succession. So like I mentioned, there's certain species and types of species that tend to do well after just big disturbances. And those are often combinations of species we can work with to clean up pollution, whether it's after fires or after a big industrial impact. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the major principles. Also, just that diversity as resilience piece. So we're never just incorporating a single kingdom of life or a single species in nature. All kinds of organisms, every life creates food and habitat for another life, which kind of ties into, and all, sorry, all of that leads to greater resilience, right? If we, with the example we just talked about, like if you're like, okay, we're doing a tree planting effort, we're going to do a monoculture for some reason, and we're going to just only plant pine trees or something, that's not a very resilient system. It's very easy for that to get taken out. Mm-hmm. And especially in stressed and disturbed systems, it's really important to have a whole, diversity of species and kingdoms of life present so they can support each other, first of all, because most beings live in relationship and interrelationship, but also so that if, a couple of those organisms don't do as well in that specific really tough environment, then there's others that can kind of like get things going and get that cycle started. Another principle is waste as a resource. So similarly, like, yeah, in nature, there isn't waste. Everything is, food or habitat for another life. So we try to work with waste as much as we can. And instead of sending stuff away, we, maybe we can utilize it in our projects. Mm-hmm. And then similarly, we try to, with these pollution cleanup methods, not externalize the problem into other communities, whether human or non-human, and actually, take good care and even just utilize any byproducts of the remediation process. So, plants that pull up metals, which do not break down, could become, perhaps biofuel or useful objects, or, we're looking at biochar creation from some of these materials once the metals are extracted. And then also, considering succession, considering that systems change over time. Change is a part of systems. And usually after a big disturbance like pollution or fire, we want to, we're starting over. And we don't want to work with invasive species in that process. So, using bioregional approaches. I think I covered some of the main principles of ecological remediation there.
Could you give, who are some of the first responders that come after a big disturbance?
Yeah, it's a lot of plants that even if they're native plants, we consider them to be weeds. And what that means is they're fast growing. Mm-hmm. They come in after disturbance. Often they have root systems and like physiologies that can thrive. So like one of the plants we work with a lot that's native to California and that pulls up lead and other metals is telegraph weed. It's literally called telegraph weed, even though it's a native plant, because it grows this amazing taproot that allows it to dig down through really compacted soils. We also tend to see, so for the for the fungi nerds out there, you might know some of the different categories of fungi, right? We have fungi from the Basidiomycota mycota or the Ascomycota, but if you've ever heard of like fungi growing inside of Chernobyl and growing on contaminated sites and growing after fires, they tend to be from the Ascomycota. And those are like early successional. They're really good, similar to those early successional plants. They drop in really stressful conditions and they can make stuff work. no matter the stress or the pollution. And as they do that and just live their lives, they, again, like I said, create food and habitat for other organisms. Mm-hmm. They work themselves, all of these species work themselves out of a job. So I have seen again and again, you know, after working on this stuff for many years, I've seen sites that were dominated by invasive species while polluted, you know, after cleaning up the pollution and getting that system kind of reorganized, regenerated, become these, you know, native habitats. So really often those early successional species kind of work themselves out of a job and create space for more life to come in later.
The listeners, we're going to have a break right now. We're going to come right back to talk with Danielle about CARES funding from FireAid to support full service soil remediation, grant funded full service soil remediation. So stick around.
Hey listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying EcoJustice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests, listen to extended episodes, and get connected with us on social media. Today, you're listening to Nature's Remedy, Healing Our Earth with Ecological Remediation. Host Carrie Kim and guest Danielle Stevenson, pioneering mycologist, environmental scientist, and educator. More from Merlin Sheldrake from the 2024 Pioneers Conference in Berkeley, where he stresses how critically important fungi are and discusses the visionary work of the Society for the Protection of Underground Networks, SPUN, and its efforts to map and protect the mycorrhizal fungal communities of the planet.
A recent study that Toby and I were part of found that mycorrhizal fungi funnel around 13 billion tons of CO2 into the soil every year. That's as much as a third of the total CO2 emissions produced by the burning of fossil fuels every year. It's a significant amount of carbon. They stabilize this carbon in the soil and power soil food webs, which contain over half of all species on the planet. So globally, the total length of mycorrhizal fungal mycelium in the top 10 centimeters of soil is more than 450 quadrillion kilometers, which is over half of the width of the galaxy. These organisms are stationed at a vital point in global carbon and nutrient cycles, and they make up one of the circulatory systems of the planet, an ancient life support system that easily qualifies as one of the wonders of the living world. But despite their roles in supporting planetary biodiversity and regulating the Earth's nutrient cycles and climate, mycorrhizal fungi are a global blind spot, largely absent from climate change agendas, conservation strategies, restoration strategies, agriculture, and forestry. And this is a problem. It's a problem, first, because mycorrhizal fungi lie at the base of the food webs that sustain much of life on Earth and make a key lever in planetary ecology. And yet, hardly anyone is touching this lever. It would be like trying to perform life-saving surgery without taking into account the circulatory systems of our bodies. It's a problem for another reason. What we are blind to, we tend to destroy. The destruction of underground ecosystems accelerates climate change, biodiversity loss, and what's more, when we disrupt these communities, we destroy an ancient library of solutions that fungi have evolved to rise to the challenge of living. We have no idea how many of these solutions might prove vital to life on Earth moving forward. When mycorrhizal fungi suffer, so do the organisms and the ecosystems that depend on them. So, back to this question. How can we nourish generative relationships with these ancient life support systems to support the flourishing of life on Earth and respond to climate and biodiversity crises? I'm going to describe two projects that I work on with Toby, and Toby has summarized these briefly. And the first is, as Toby says, this grand, very big, zoomed-out perspective. It's the Society for the Protection of Underground Networks, or SPUN, and SPUN is trying to answer this question by taking a global perspective, using huge data sets to map the mycorrhizal communities of the planet and advocate for their protection. The second approach zooms all the way in, We use advanced microscopy, robotics, machine learning tools to look inside mycorrhizal fungi to try and decode the flows and behavioral dialects of these living sensing networks. So one of the ways we can form relationships with these ancient life support systems is by stopping destroying them. And Spun's work is trying to facilitate this. There are lots of threats to underground ecosystems, despite the fact that we think about them less than we should. Deforestation, desertification, overapplication of industrial agricultural chemicals like fungicides and fertilizers, overplowing, any number of things, the list goes on. The combination, the result of all of this combination is that based on current trends, 90% of the Earth's soils will be degraded by 2050.
Listeners, we are back with Danielle Stevenson from the Center for Applied Ecological Remediation. What is the concern around when that you have a remediation project and then it's pulling up, whether it's heavy metals or some other toxic pollutant for animals or birds or anyone to pick up on that? How do you address that?
Great question. Yeah, that has to be part of your design, is how to be responsible, right? Responsible caretakers for the project and for the site and for the pollution. So that looks like monitoring to collect any edible portions of, products from the site, like mushrooms or, seeds or things like that. So they're not getting eaten and spread in the environment.
Can you share some of the ways that listeners can stay in touch with you, Danielle?
Yeah. Best way, check out caer.earth. We have our website. There's ways to get involved and connect that way. You can send me an email. I'm usually slow to respond, but I do love to collaborate and connect and share. So Danielle@care.earth is another way. We're on Instagram. We're on Blue Sky. We're on LinkedIn. We're online.
Fantastic. Danielle, thank you so much to you, Sean Juan, the team over at CARE, and all that you're doing for communities. And listeners, do visit care.earth. There is so much information there. Follow Danielle on her social media, LinkedIn, and all these other places, and get involved. If you actually, especially if you're local or wherever you live, if there's issues, get involved in changing the place back to the way it was intended to be. Thank you.
Hey, listeners, to check out the extended recording of this show or to explore our other shows, visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, and subscribe to our podcast. This has been Ecojustice Radio and our show, Nature's Remedy, Healing Our Earth with Ecological Remediation. Thank you to our guest, Danielle Stevenson, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at Ecojustice Radio, SoCal350, and Wilder Utopia if you like what you've heard. We want others to be informed. Subscribe and share the episodes. You have been listening to Ecojustice Radio, a project of SoCal 350, executive producer, myself, Jack Eit, co-host Carrie Kim, an engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
Looking for a unique way to support KPFK? Consider donating property you no longer need. It could be an inherited home, a vacant lot, or a piece of land that's just not part of your plan anymore. Your gift helps fund the programs you rely on and love. Get started today. Visit kpfk.org/real estate or call 844-277-4663 to learn more about real estate donations.
KPFK 90.7 FM presents an afternoon of community dialogue. On Saturday, August 29th, labor organizer Chris Smalls will be in conversation with journalist Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, discussing the future of the working class and his book, When the Revolution Comes. The event takes place at the First Unitarian Church of Los Angeles. Doors open at 12:30 p.m. and the event begins at 1 p.m. This presentation is a fundraiser for listener-supported KPFK. Ticket and schedule information is available at kpfk.org/smalls.
When the revolution comes, when the revolution comes, when the revolution comes.